we call everyone in this room, ask for reverence as we begin this March 14th, 2005 meeting of the Ways and Means Human Services Subcommittee. We're a little bit short of a quorum, but that'll change as time goes forward. We'd like to welcome Mary Claire Buckley, Executive Director for the Psychiatric Security Review Board, and receive your presentation today.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. I did want to first begin by indicating to you that, unfortunately, because this hearing was rescheduled from last Wednesday to this morning, the board chair as well as other board members are unable to attend, as they at this very moment are over at the state hospital conducting hearings, but they would have been here otherwise and hope to be here in phase two. Members should have with them, I believe you already have the finder with the governor's recommended budget, as well as a blue notebook that contains the outline of the presentation that I will make this morning. I expect to follow that basically in line, except for a little poetic license when I give you a little historical perspective before getting to the mission and function. Mm-hmm. The Psychiatric Security Review Board is the state agency that assumes jurisdiction over all those found guilty except for insanity of a crime by a judge or jury who may pose a substantial danger to others. That is, all those who successfully assert the insanity defense. It was created in 1977 by this legislature as a unique experiment, the first of its kind in the nation, for the management and treatment of insanity clients. Prior to that time, the process for the disposition of insanity acquittees was quite different. Individual judges maintained jurisdiction over persons found what was called not responsible by reason of mental disease or defect at that time. And once that finding was made, the statutes required the judges to decide if the individual should be committed to the state hospital. If so, the judge continued to be responsible for deciding when to release that person into the community. The reality of that meant that when the hospital staff thought the individual was ready for conditional release or discharge, it would petition the court for a hearing. However, judges had a very limited opportunity to monitor the progress of these individuals in the hospital, as there was very little communication or collaboration between the two entities. So courts often just deferred to the recommendations of the hospital staff. Without the necessary funds or staff, judges were unable to create effective conditional release plans to monitor the person's performance once released, or to return them to the hospital if their mental health deteriorated, rendering them a danger. Later it was found that the courts had lost track of many of those in the community under their jurisdiction. The result was no supervision and risk to the community. At the same time, the Mental Health Division was faced with a growing number of insanity acquittees and overcrowded forensic wards. Perhaps as a result of these pressures, many individuals were released from the hospital after a very short stay. Although we have no statistics available today, the public perceived that these early releases committed new crimes. There was widespread concern that the insanity defense did nothing to protect the public. As a response to those concerns, the two separate task forces, one in corrections and one in mental health, were convened to study the defense. They concurred that the system in place then was not working well. Thus, the Psychiatric Security Review Board was created to deal with these systemic problems. It was created as a separate state agency, independent of the mental health and criminal justice systems, although working closely with both, with responsibility for monitoring all those who were found not responsible due to mental disease or defect. The legislature structured the agency to ensure the board's autonomy in decision-making, so that its determinations are based on clinical and risk assessments of the client rather than any political or census considerations. It was set up and continues to be a part-time, five-member, multidisciplinary board. Its membership is comprised by statute of a psychiatrist and psychologist who are experienced in criminal justice system, an attorney with criminal trial practice, a parole or probation officer, and a member of the general public. The enabling statutes in the Chapter 161 direct the board to have as its primary concern the protection of society. Thus, in many ways, it is a public safety agency that bridges both the mental health and criminal justice systems. The board has done its best to fulfill that mandate, as evidenced by its extremely low recidivism rate over the years, which we will discuss in greater detail in a few minutes. It has managed that task while ever mindful of the rights of its clients and their need for an appropriate level of care and treatment. The board's mission is to protect the public through the ongoing review of the progress of persons found guilty except for insanity, as the defense is now called, and a determination of their appropriate placement. The board's options for placement are commitment to a secure forensic ward at the state hospital, release to a highly structured and supervised program in the community on a conditional release, or outright discharge from jurisdiction. In making these determinations, once again, the law requires that the board consider public safety first. The board, charged with both ensuring public safety and providing for the care and treatment of its clients, has three primary goals. The first is to continue its success in meeting this overriding mandate to protect the public. This is accomplished through the informed and effective determination of the appropriate placement of its clients in a hearing process and then the subsequent monitoring of those individuals in the community. The board provides citizens protection from those offenders in need of continued hospitalization while carefully monitoring those who can be adequately treated in the community through conditional release. In so doing, the board performs a critical public safety function, as once again evidenced by its low recidivism rate, which for the 2003-05 biennium is currently 1%. The board's second goal is linked to the first in that part of the board's mission and statutory responsibility is to facilitate the placement of its clients in the setting deemed most appropriate by the board through the hearing process. The board has worked very closely with the Department of Human Services and the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, as well as with community providers, to help ensure that the department receives and expends the funds necessary for the conditional release of PSRB clients housed at Oregon State Hospital, whom the board has determined could be adequately treated and controlled in the community. This has been a major challenge in the past and continues to be so, as I'm sure you know. The development of new residential placements and the necessary attendant treatment and support services has not kept pace with the need resulting from the caseload in the past. However, a major concerted effort has been undertaken this biennium to address this problem, and a significant improvement in this area is expected by the end of June. But not only immediate, but ongoing attention must be focused on the needs of the forensic population, as it appears the numbers will not diminish in the foreseeable future. There continue to be a significant number of PSRB clients who remain in OSH solely due to the lack of appropriate resources in the community. Supervising these individuals in the community is both cost-effective and desirable from the viewpoint of rehabilitation and recovery. A huge cost savings is realized by the Department of Human Services and ultimately the taxpayer when appropriate clients are allowed to return to the community to live in structured and supportive settings with the treatment services they need rather than...
Senator Moss Sanderson.
Yes. I'm very aware of the private company mm-hmm. that we, the state, have contracted with who houses... our psychiatric patients, and I would. Will you be covering in your talk that organization and how I've heard from Mr. Nickel that it is extremely successful with the one that we have now for community-based housing, and I figure if we've got an organization that has proven to deal with these patients very well, and I'm not sure if they're forensics, that's why it would be nice to get some information, but here is a private company that's been out seeking places in the community and then housing our patients, and I'd be very interested in getting a little more information on that to see how successful it is and what problems we are having with that.
Chair Richardson, Senator Morris Anderson, I am familiar, I believe you're referring to Telecare in your community.
Yeah,
and I wasn't going to address them directly, but I can answer your question either at
just
this
answer
point.
The question, yeah.
Certainly, Telecare has offered to serve our clients and set up a secure residential treatment facility in Gresham. And they have previously served the civil population. They have the program already in Gresham, as you know, that serves persons from the adult treatment side, and have been extraordinarily successful in that endeavor. We have met with them numerous times, and I have every confidence that they could serve our clients as well. They, as I said, are willing to open a secure residential facility in your district, and we were anxiously looking forward to that. There is a tremendous need for secure residential facilities, as I'm sure you're aware, and they were more than willing, and we had, as I said, every confidence they could do a very good job for us.
Follow up. And I was also curious, do they have secure residential places elsewhere in other states or here, or is this going to be the first one that they're going to take on?
Chair Richardson, Senator Morton-Sanderson, there are other secure residential facilities in Oregon. We have opened one in Jackson County.
With telecare or someone else?
No, with Jackson County Mental Health took that on. I think telecare is probably, if not the right now, may be our only private provider, but there are a couple others in Multnomah County. Arbor Place and Faulkner Place are two facilities that are designated as secure residential, and we're in the process of developing a few more of those because there is a need for that level of step down from the hospital.
As you're aware, follow up again, as you're aware, the neighborhoods always say, not in my backyard, and I'm hoping that we can get some information regarding these other secure residential services and show that at least the city councilors or mayors how successful they are and how these patients, if they're properly medicated and properly monitored, that they're fine. And I think I've talked with Mr. Nickel about this, and I know that that's his priority too, but we need to get the communities to understand that these places are absolutely necessary to have.
Chair Richardson, Senator Moniz, I would welcome any opportunity to get that information for you. Clearly that is the biggest barrier or hurdle we have in citing in opening some residential facilities for our clients. They don't have that understanding of, and I hope, you know, through my presentation you'll see and can share with your constituents too, that when this, you know, model is done, they are more secure than they actually realize, and that they should not be as much afraid of our clients, but those that they don't know about.
That's true.
Could you go into a little more detail about, do you know the costs of when we're using something like Jackson County Mental Health or telecare?
Chair Richardson, I believe that the cost, and I could get back to you on it, but around $8,000 a month per client is the number. It sticks in my head off the top of my head. But that obviously is Medicaid match is available for that facility, which is not available for most of our clients at the state hospital. So it brings it that number down significantly in terms of general fund dollars.
Do all of these patient defendants have their faculties about them physically? I mean, are they all ambulatory, or are some of them dual situations where they have, you know, extreme medical needs as well as mental?
Chair Richardson, many of them are, you know, physically fine, although there are a small percentage. And what we have attempted to do this in this biennium is develop a range of new facilities, and one of them is for the for some persons with medical needs that we're going to open in April in Multnomah County, and there's another facility in Yamhill County that's to open where we may have a couple of beds available to our clients for the more physically challenged ones with more severe medical issues. So what we tried to do in this process was identify the different subpopulations of the PSRB clients that are in need. And, you know, for example, transitional youth, you know, young persons between 18 and 25 often fall through, you know, or have difficulty because they don't quite fit that, you know, usual mold. As I will tell you, our median age of the clients under the board is 42. And so when you try and put a 18, 19-year-old, you know, young person into a foster home with them, it just doesn't work. So we've identified, as I said, those individuals, the medically needy sex offenders, which obviously are tremendously difficult, you know, to place in the community. So we've identified those kind of subpopulations and have worked to build, you know, separate, you know, residential programs for each of those.
Okay. Other questions?
As you can see, the huge savings would be had. The current figures show that most regular community supervision slots cost substantially less than the annual cost of forensic hospitalization, which is close to $110,000 of straight general fund dollars. To this end, the board will strive to establish relationships with community mental health agencies who have not previously worked with board clients. It will give them whatever technical support and assistance that is necessary to get them to agree to become a player in the forensic system. The services required for this population are more comprehensive and intense than their usual mental health client, especially for the smaller and more rural counties who have suffered huge setbacks in their budgets in the recent past. The board will do whatever it can, as limited as that may be, to assure these agencies that the board will continue to be a resource for them and that funding for such investment will be adequate and permanent. In addition, the board plans to enhance the partnerships it already has in place with existing mental health agencies so that they will be willing not only to continue, but also in many situations to expand the provisions of service to a greater number of PSRB clients. The board's third goal is to strengthen its strategic partnerships with both public and private sectors, as you noted, through both outreach and technological enhancements. The outreach is just what I alluded to with regards to the relationships with both current and prospective providers and agencies. The technological enhancements contemplated further improvements to our database so that it could be shared with our partners, including the Office of Mental Health, Oregon State Hospital, and our community providers. However, the funding for such a project is not contained in this proposed budget and therefore will remain an aim of the board for the future. In addition, the board has a long-standing relationship with the psychiatric research section of Oregon Health and Sciences University, in which data is shared so that mutually useful and beneficial research studies can be conducted. The board will continue these projects within the limitation of its current database. As you can see from the folder, the PSRB is consolidated into one program unit, although there are two aspects to the program, that is, providing statutorily required hearings for its clients and closely supervising those on conditional release in the community. Thus, its targets groups consist of two primary constituencies, the general public, which is comprised, obviously, of all the citizens of the state, and then those persons who have been placed under the board. Those individuals, by definition, suffer from a mental disease or defect, which, when active, can cause them to pose a substantial danger to others. They are placed under the board by a trial court, as I mentioned, and the length of jurisdiction is equal to the maximum sentence they could have received had they been found guilty. Sentencing guidelines do not apply. There are currently 726 individuals under the board's jurisdiction, which you'll notice an increase from the number that I just gave you last week in that folder. Most are indigent, and their sole source of income is SSI or SSD. Schizophrenia is the predominant diagnosis. The vast majority have a history of alcohol or drug abuse as well. About 96% of our clients are under the board for felony offenses, and of that, 75% are under the board for serious person felonies, such as assault, arson, homicide. Women account for 17% of our clients, and as I mentioned, the mean age is 42. These clients are served through both aspects of the board's program by a panel of 5 board members and a staff of 4 FTE currently, as you can see in the organization chart on page 5. The first aspect is the hearings. This is the legal process during which the board hears testimony and receives evidence and then makes its careful and deliberate decision as to the client's appropriate placement. 3 of the 5 board members sit as a panel. The board meets at Oregon State Hospital and hears a variety of types of hearings. At each hearing, the board must decide certain legal issues. first whether the individual continues to suffer from a mental disease or defect, and then whether he continues to pose a substantial danger to others when that illness is active. If so, the board maintains jurisdiction and then must decide whether, in fact, the person could be adequately controlled and treated in the community. The board exercises due caution in deciding who may be released. It utilizes a comprehensive process which includes an assessment by the professional treatment staff at Oregon State Hospital after the client has successfully completed the treatment program there, a thorough independent assessment and evaluation by a community mental health agency to determine whether they agree with the hospital's assessment, and if so, they develop a plan to provide the adequate supervision and treatment the client needs, and then a final review and approval of those conditions by the board. At each hearing, the client is entitled to be represented by counsel, and if indigent, as most are appointed an attorney who has a contract with the state. The state is usually represented by the Attorney General's office, although the district attorney from the county of commitment occasionally appears. The client has the right to appeal the board's decision directly to the Court of Appeals, which requires our staff to prepare the hearing transcript and the appeal documents. The Attorney General's office represents the board on those appeals. If the client is approved for conditional release, then the second and equally important aspect of our program is triggered, and that is the monitoring of clients in the community. This is called conditional release and is, at least initially, a highly structured and supervised release. The board works in concert with the Office of Mental Health and community mental health agencies and their case managers and treatment providers to assure treatment and supervision of its clients outside the hospital. The Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services budget contains the funding to contract with community mental health providers to do this. The board's monitoring function is primarily delegated to the executive director and the three staff members who work very closely with all case managers throughout the state to track these clients' progress. The case managers have the daily hands-on responsibility, and they coordinate the care and treatment with the board and staff. Case managers are required to file reports with the board on a monthly basis and to call at any time conditions of release are violated or a person's mental health starts to deteriorate. Staff receives calls and correspondence on a daily basis regarding various issues affecting clients, such as requests for travel, changes in residence, etc. Another mechanism for tracking clients is the law enforcement data system terminal that we have in our office, which notifies us immediately of any contact a client may have with police personnel. Printouts are received on that computer throughout the day that need to be followed up by staff with calls to the officer involved as well as to the case manager who is responsible for that particular client. The board keeps very close tabs on its clients. A change in mental health status or violation of the terms of the conditional release order could result in the issuance of a revocation order.
Question, Mr. Chair?
Senator Moss Anderson.
Thank you. One thing about these clients, and I don't know how you monitor it, so many of them will go off their medication. I'm not sure that that's the case with your clients, but having worked with other mental health clients, they start feeling good and everything seems to be going well, and then they stop their medication. And there's no way that you can monitor that, is there, other than behavior changes?
Chair Richardson, Senator Moss Anderson, we do actually monitor that as well. Most individuals who leave the hospital go to supervised group homes to begin with, and that medication is administered and monitored, and their ingestion is monitored. It is a requirement of conditional release order contains the requirement that our clients have to take their medication, and if they do not, they are subject to the revocation that I'm speaking about. This order constitutes sufficient warrant for the police to take the person into custody and return them immediately to the state hospital. This entire process from report to rehospitalization may be accomplished in just a few hours. With this authority, the board does not have to wait to take action until the individual violates the law or causes harm. It is by this system of close monitoring that the board has been able to fulfill its statutory mandate. In order to accomplish all this, the board employs 4 FTE to carry out its daily functions. Each is dependent on the other. The 4 positions include an executive director, who is the principal staff person to the board. She handles the day-to-day operations of the board, advises the board on legal matters and other issues at the hearings, and monitors the status of clients in the community through constant communication with case managers. She's responsible for personnel matters, acts as a liaison with mental health and criminal justice systems, develops and presents budgetary and legislative matters to the legislature, and serves as the board's official representative. The staff is composed of a secretary who, as you can imagine, handles all the functions that are attendant with that, including phone calls, reception, correspondence, notices to victims, filing, typing, transcription, accounts payable, the photocopying, the myriad of duties that come with that position. I also have two administrative assistants. One is responsible for the hearing functions, which include compiling and marking exhibits, organizing and disseminating case files, scheduling hearings and board panels, and attending the hearings to tape record the proceedings for possible appeal as required by law. She also prepares the files to be sent to the community for evaluation when requested by the hospital staff. The other administrative assistant is the case summary coordinator and computer specialist who reviews and condenses all past and current medical, psychological, social, and criminal histories of all persons under the board's jurisdiction into summaries which the board members use to prepare for hearings. She also prepares all of the agency's statistical reports and is responsible for the maintenance of our computer network. The staff work as a team and cross-trained so that vital duties are always covered. Working with this population requires that the staff use professional judgment and understand complex terminology in the medical and legal field. This is the staffing pattern that has existed since 1988. And then moving on to the performance measures, starting on page 7, I would note that the board has kept results-oriented performance measures since 1992. It developed 3 standards to measure efficiency and 3 measures for effectiveness. Pursuant to the direction of the Progress Board and its new system, of those we selected 4 key measures which linked to 3 goals and 1 Oregon benchmark. The review committee found the link benchmark is relevant and makes a good link. Further, the committee found that these measures reflected the agency's scope of work and provide a picture of the board's operations and meet the basic criteria. The initial targets we submitted appeared ambitious to the committee, considering the 2002 data. They were the same as you see for the targets in 2001 and 2 in Appendix C. So we have adjusted these to be more realistic, given that both the agency and community providers have at their disposal. As you can see on the performance measures, our first goal, once again, is to protect the public. This relates to Oregon Benchmark 64, adult recidivism. We adjusted what was a Department of Corrections benchmark to make it applicable to our clients. And performance measure number 1 of the board provides the most important measure of the ultimate outcome of board decisions by tracking the number of clients on conditional release that are revoked for committing a new felony. As you can see, in 2000, that percentage was 0, and in 2001, it was 3.1%. Unfortunately, this figure shot up in 2002. But as I mentioned when I sat here 2 years ago, we were hopeful that this was an aberration, and it appears that it was just that. For in 2003, our rate went back to 0%, and in the calendar year 2004, it was 1%.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Thank you. What number is this? You might have said it earlier, but I just forget.
64.
Yeah. Thank you.
As you can see from the last few years' data, the board has historically been extremely successful in maintaining a low rate, which is a critical measure of public safety. Since the agency began keeping performance measures in 1992, the overall recidivism rate is only 2%. Our target for this measure has always previously been 0, as you can see from the data summary sheet in Appendix C, because it was the board's belief that should be the goal given its mandate. Setting it at anything less seemed unacceptable. But after conversations with the Progress Board, I learned that the agency should be more realistic with its targets, given the circumstances of this difficult population and the resources. So this, as well as the other targets, have been adjusted for 2005, 6, and 7, as you might see.
I have a question. Would you mind commenting on why there's been such an increase in the number of defendants in this regard? I mean, has there been a change in the way that, in the definition to qualify, or just has this become very popular with defense attorneys, or what do you think?
Chair Richardson, I've struggle with that, too, because as you can see, you know, it just even in the past couple of years. And I think there are a number of factors that may contribute to this, although, I don't think we have any, real, tenable or data that, explains all of this. But I think clearly, any increase in the state's population will bring with it an increase in the number of persons with, mental health difficulties. Secondly, I think that you may see or there may be some correlation between the fact that, the Oregon Health Plan was cut back and the ability to get mental health treatment under that plan a couple of years ago and the increase. Because I think as you see that when people can't get the services they need, they come to the attention of law enforcement officers and then basically end up in the criminal justice system, and then a small percentage of them then proceed to assert this defense. I think also the increase in the use of drug and alcohol, and particularly the methamphetamine epidemic, has not escaped our notice. There are a number of people who become psychotic when they use those substances and, then commit crimes and assert the defense. I think that, ballot measure 11, even though it's been around, for a number of years, still is a factor. In years past, the coming under the board was much more onerous than going through the correction system, frankly. We keep our clients a lot longer usually, and even though they're not sentences, the dispositions were longer. Having been a defense attorney prior to this job, we used to say that, our clients may be mentally ill, but they weren't stupid. And when they, when you tell them, insanity is an affirmative defense in Oregon, and they get to choose. And when you tell them, well, you could go, even get probation for certain crimes in the old days, or go under the board and go to the hospital and not know how long you might be there, they often chose the former. And I think now, given that those ballot measure 11 sentences are longer, then it gives somebody a better idea that maybe it would be worthwhile to them to go through this system where they're going to get care and treatment rather than DOC, which, as you well know, has its own struggles right now in terms of dealing with the great number of persons suffering from a mental illness that are in their facilities all over the state as well. So, can I tell you exactly what the reason for the recent spike is? No, but I think those are some of the factors that, you could consider as reasons.
Okay, thank you.
I will tell you that that although these targets for 2005, 6, and 7 have been raised, in this regard, the board will strive not to meet the targets in any of the coming years. Because actually we pride ourselves on being as low as possible, obviously. Yet the board is cognizant of the fact that there are factors which may well impact this measure in the future. First is that, as you know, statistically speaking, the more individuals you have on conditional release in the community, the more likely it is that someone might commit such an offense. Secondly, one of the reasons that our recidivism rate is so low is because we are able to monitor these individuals quite closely. But our ability to do so is going to be impacted unless, I believe, additional staff is obtained to do this, because we're anticipating a huge increase in the number of persons placed in the community, even by the end of this biennium, never mind by the next. The Office of Mental Health has plans for, I believe it is, 96 additional community beds by the end of June this year, and in their budget for the next biennium has targeted another 94, I believe, or 96 additional community beds for this population. The second goal we have is to review the client's progress in a timely manner, and that involves two aspects, each of which were assigned a performance measure. The first is the percentage of hearings set within statutory timeframes you'll see on page 9. By way of explanation, in the enabling statutes, there are a number of different types of hearings that the board must hold, and each of these has a time frame delineated in the statute. This is illustrated for you in Appendix A. For example, an initial hearing must be held within 90 days of arrival at the state hospital. Revocations must be held within 20 days of return. So staff must track when each client is due a particular hearing and when it has been set within the time required. Once again, you can see from Appendix C that our goal used to be 100% of the time because that is the expectation of the statute. However, as you can also see, we still fall short, although we just missed our target of 90% in 2003 and exceeded the 90% in 2004.
Taking just a moment.
Sure.
Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you back up just for a moment?
Sure.
You mentioned the additional personnel. Are you thinking additional personnel beyond the additional FTE that's added in the...
Chair Richardson, Representative Hannah, no. That the one FTE that's in the governor's recommended budget is what we had.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And follow-up
on
that question. As more are being, although it doesn't seem like we're placing too many more in the community, but as people are placed in the community, that should decrease the number that need to be in the state hospital, but increase the number in the community, correct? I mean, I wrong that way, and are your FTEs include those that are in the community? Or only for the state hospital?
Chair Richardson, Senator Mona Anderson, actually, most of the monitoring we do is for the clients in the community. You know,
okay.
We know where they are when they're in the hospital, but it's when they get out there is when we need that ability. The inability to reach 100% of our, in this particular measure, is attributable in part to the budget cuts the board has suffered in the past, as the board no longer can meet weekly. They now usually meet three times a month, and thus, particularly with revocations, it is difficult to fit into that 20-day window because the board has to gather additional exhibits and provide notice not only to the Attorney General but to the victims and other interested parties. The other consideration, frankly, is one of workload. The board could improve this measure by setting hearings whether the parties were ready or not. Yet, to be honest, sometimes judgments are made as to whether it is more important to set a hearing or to hold a meaningful one. On occasion, for example, the client's treating psychiatrist or some other critical witness may not be available on the date when this hearing is due, and all parties believe that the testimony is necessary. In this situation, the board could set the hearing without regard to those factors, but it would just realistically mean that once we got to the hearing that morning, either attorney would ask for a continuance, and the board would have to grant it. So practically speaking, it would have been a waste of time, as nothing would be accomplished other than the attainment of our measure. My staff would then have to go back through the whole process, the workload, to prepare and notify all the same interested parties for a hearing, which must be reset within 60 days. And given our current situation, I often opt for the late date. The other measure related to reviewing clients' progress in the community, is the percentage of monthly reports received on time, which is performance measure number 3 on page 10. By way of explanation, again, the statute and thus the board requires case managers to file monthly reports on each client in the community by a certain date of the month. As you can see, there is even more room for improvement here. The board has taken steps with its tardy providers on numerous occasions to impress upon them the need to submit these in a more timely fashion. However, I will assure you that just because the paper is not in does not mean the board is unaware of the client's status or progress in the community. We keep in regular and at times daily contact with most of my case managers, so I am well aware of how various clients are doing, even if the form has not been submitted by the set date. I think this will continue to be problematic for case managers with large caseloads, as paperwork usually takes a backseat to the provision of services to clients as well. Maybe it should. However, as a result of some questions Ms. Manthe asked of me with regard to this measure, I've had some thoughts about the utility of this measure and would welcome the committee's feedback. As I mentioned earlier, we first developed this measure back in 92 and chose ones that related to the board's mission and statutory functions. The statute requires that we receive these monthly reports, and certainly these reports are a tool that I utilize in monitoring a client's progress. But the measure is not very meaningful for other purposes. In fact, in analyzing the data, we could find no correlation between late reports and revocations, for example, or problems in the community. As a matter of fact, an argument could probably be made to the contrary. I should also note that in the old performance measure system, when the agency had to weight the various measures, this one was always weighted the lowest. It may well be time to examine whether this should remain one of the measures to report out, or whether we should continue to track it for internal purposes only. The third goal is to determine the appropriate placement of PSRB clients. This would also illustrate the effectiveness of the board's decisions in determining who should be released from the hospital. This performance measure is the percentage of conditional releases maintained in the community per month, as noted on page 11. That is, how many of those granted release to the community stay there and are not revoked and not returned to Oregon State Hospital in a particular month. The current statistics, you will see, illustrate that the board is doing quite well in this area. In 2004, we actually surpassed our target. The board is currently averaging about 6 revocations a month and is maintained and has 299 individuals on conditional release at this point. Thus, 98.7% of those to whom the board granted conditional release stay out in the community without a problem. This measure provides the board with some insight into its own decision making, as well as the hospital's treatment and preparation of clients for conditional release, and a community provider's ability to manage them when they get there.
Why is the target a diminishing one over the next 3 years?
Chair Richardson, for the same reason the Progress Board had advised us that our measures were much too optimistic, and given that we were going to have more individuals, where we were anticipating more individuals out in the community, they expected that this measure would logically go down. And so,
well, of course, we're not dealing with absolute numbers, we're dealing with percentages.
Sure.
So more people,
sure,
means, you know, more percentage.
Right.
I mean, percentages are not directly related to the number of people that are out there. It's on a percentage basis, and so. Who makes the decision that it should go? You know, you've been maintaining, and we congratulate you, you know, approximately 98.45 for 5 or 6 years, and now it's supposed to go down to 95%. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Chair Richardson, I can only tell you that, once again, the board previously had this at 100%, you know, believing that that was the appropriate goal, but in the workings with the Progress Board, we're advised that our target should be lower. But we would be happy to go back to our original target. It, you know, it's the board's, you know, I struggled with this in dealing with the Progress Board because, to my mind, you know, your goal should always be the best you can be. But I think they draw some distinction between targets and goals, maybe, or but clearly would be more than happy with the to change that if the committee would like us to do so.
Well, I think that certainly needs to be addressed, whether you address it or we do. But
okay.
And I don't see a difference between a goal and a target.
Right.
It's a distinction without a difference. But it just seems contrary to common sense to say you're doing so well, let's shoot for a lesser number.
I understand, Chair Richardson.
Representative Hammond.
No, thank you, Chair Richardson. I hate to reiterate, but even going back to goal one, you're averaging over the data years provided 3.28, and you're moving it to 5. And on this one, you're averaging 98.7, and you're moving it to 95. I would just say, please take another look at that and use caution when going the wrong direction, or seemingly. You're doing so well, it seems a shame to lower the bar.
Chair Richardson, Representative Hanna, I do not anticipate that, despite what these targets say, as I said, you know, the board is not going to strive to reach these targets. We will continue to strive to keep what we have or improve on what we have. Finally, on page 12, you will find the board's prioritized list of the 10% reduction options that were submitted as required. To be frank, none of these options were very palatable given the current state of the board. to find $87,500 in a small agency where personnel makes up over 75% of its budget was no small task. Clearly, the third and fourth options present potentially huge impacts, not only to this agency, but to the forensic system as a whole, including the state hospital, which is currently suffering from the serious overcrowding, as you know. But to expound a bit, reducing the Attorney General's, on page 13, number two, to reduce the funding for Attorney General's charges is always risky, despite the fact that those costs have been contained this biennium. The reason for that is simply that the board has absolutely no control over this money at all. Neither the board nor the Attorney General has any say in the number of appeals filed. As I mentioned earlier, the clients have the right to appeal any decision from a hearing that they feel aggrieved by. And fortunately, this number has not been, I mean, the number of appeals this biennium has come down quite a bit, but in the past it has historically been a serious problem.
I haven't seen a chart that shows the numbers. Would you review those with us?
I can tell you that in this biennium there have only been 11 appeals filed. In years past, we've had 26 in a year. And, you know, this fluctuates depending upon what novel issue, you know, the attorney representing the patients might propose to the court, or, you know, and so, you know, depending on, you know, what particular thing, because actually, you know, the issues for the Court of Appeals most of the time are pretty simple. You know, the board, as I mentioned, has to find, you know, do they have a mental disease or defect? Are they a danger if that illness is active? And could they, be adequately controlled and treated? And those are the three legal issues, and that's what the court has to look at. But when you get issues like, you know, drug and alcohol abuse, as is currently one of the major issues facing, you know, the board and actually the Supreme Court at this very moment, that tends to generate a number of appeals. Because we're waiting for the Supreme Court to decide an important issue that was the reason for many of those 26 appeals in years past, they're waiting for that decision, and so we've had a lull in the number of appeals. But, you know, at any point that could, go up. I just, like I said, have no control over that. Furthermore, the board has little control over the charges that are incurred for each appeal. Several biennia ago, when, you know, the costs were skyrocketing, and the board did work out a gentle person's agreement with the Department of Justice regarding the, you know, top number or some kind of range of hours that they would spend on a typical appeal. And but that's not always possible if somebody raises a particularly, as I said, novel legal issue. And furthermore, if the case goes to the Supreme Court, all bets are off because they spend, you know, a substantial number of additional hours preparing for that particular argument and that appearance before the court.
Do you recall what the 0-3-5 budget used as its estimate for a number of appeals? I mean, if you've had 26 in one year before, I assume that you would assume for 0-3-5 there would be a number of appeals.
Chair Richardson, the 26 were probably three or four biennia ago. It has not been a problem either in the last biennium or this biennium. So we had, I believe, $38,000 in the 0305 for Attorney General costs as a result of not having, you know, used as much in the previous biennium. I would guess it would have been about the same number of appeals in that biennium, you know, 12 or 13 or so.
Okay, thank you.
The board is hopeful that the amount allotted in the governor's recommended budget for this 2005-07 biennium will be sufficient. As I said, given the reduction in the number of appeals filed in the recent years compared with our historical average, the board has every reason to believe it will be. But, you know, we can't guarantee anything because there are so many factors beyond our control. However, to take $15,000 additional from the $38,000, I think, only sets up an eventuality of a visit to the emergency board. And frankly, that is the only occasion that the board has appeared in the past before the E-Board was because at one point the I think the bills went up to $96,000 at one point. So it just is out there, and I just bring it to your attention, not because I anticipate it, but because, you know, it could occur. Even more troubling is the option to reduce the number of budgeted hearing days, which is number 3 on your list. This would leave the board with only 58 hearing days for the entire biennium. This creates a serious concern because of the impact this action would have on the board's mission and its ability to meet its statutory obligations. As I've mentioned, the statute sets out the time frames for hearings, and since the inception of performance measures, the board has tried to pay attention to this issue and has worked hard to improve the percentage of hearings held in a timely fashion. It is always a challenge, as I mentioned, but has proven even more difficult as the tremendous growth in caseload continues. It is a given that more clients under the board, it is given that the more clients the client has under its jurisdiction, the more hearings it's required to schedule, as each client is required to have and is entitled to request periodic reviews. This growth trend continues unabated. As I mentioned, there are 126 more clients in total under the board than there were when I sat here 2 years ago. Thus, any reduction in hearing days would clearly offset the gains in performance measures that have been made and return the board to a precarious position of being at risk for a lawsuit. However, such a substantial reduction of 18 in the number of hearing days without drastically amending our statutes would assure the board of major civil litigation for failure to provide the statutory mandatory hearings within the legal timeframes that the legislature had set forth. And that may end up being more costly than funding the hearing days, frankly. The board would have to propose that a client's initial hearing be held 6 months rather than 90 days from a commitment, that the patient requested go from 6 months to a year, perhaps. And these changes would be necessary to help decrease the need for hearing days. However, the board has not submitted such a legislative concept, as previous attempts in two prior sessions to change the timeframes were unsuccessful, and now does not appear to be the time to try again. The reason for that is that more important than the effect on our measures would be the serious unintended consequences this option would have on both Oregon State Hospital and community providers at the most inopportune time. It would adversely impact census at Oregon State Hospital and significantly add to an already critical situation at the hospital, as clients would not be conditionally released as quickly as they otherwise would be. Finally, and worst of all, is the option to reduce current staffing of the 4 FTE by 0.75 of a staff. I trust the absurdity of this proposal is obvious given the board's request before you to consider a policy option package for an additional 1 FTE. But the board was left with no other option to meet the 10% target figure. The board would note that it could not continue to function as designed and could not possibly fulfill its statutory obligations with less staff, especially given the tremendous caseload and growth the board continues to experience annually. To the contrary, the board has concluded it cannot do its job properly without additional staff, as evidenced by the submission of that policy option package. 3/4 of a staff person's duties cannot just be absorbed by other staff. Public safety would be jeopardized as the board would be unable to monitor or respond as quickly as it should in a crisis.
You may have gone over this, but would you just tell us what is the backlog presently? You know, if we are you're looking for essentially a 20% increase or 25% increase in staffing, you know, because we're talking about FTE, we could do 0.5 FTE, we could do positions, you know, part-time. There needs to be this major step up to a full FTE. Mm-hmm. And so my question is, what is the justification other than numbers on the page? I mean, are you behind? Are people working overtime? What is it?
Chair Richardson, exactly. I think our measures have not reflected this because I would dare to say that I probably have the most conscientious staff of any agency in the state. All of us are exempt, so I can't give you overtime figures because they're not paid overtime. But I will tell you that my staff right now is averaging 55 hours a week. I have staff who are, you know, so conscientious that they would not, you know, go home until their job is done. I will tell you that on the holiday just recently, I think it was Martin Luther King Day, I went in to get some stuff done, and I walked in and found my administrative assistant there. And when I asked what she was doing there, she said, well, I want to take Friday off. This is also an individual who's worked for this agency for 25 years, is every month losing time to the state because she can't, you know, she's at her 350 hours and can't, you know, get out long enough to get that down substantially, as she earns 2 days a month virtually every month. And basically said to me, I can't take Friday off if I don't work today because I can't get my job done in 3 days. And so, frankly, in both of them, I mean, the more hearings you have, my other administrative assistant, it has to prepare the case summaries for the board. And that means reading everything in the board's file and culling that into a 10 or 12 page report for the board to review to make their job easier. So, you know, I would like to tell you I have other things, but all I can tell you is that my staff has worked, you know, I can't tell you, so much so that, you know, at some point, you know, it's not fair, it's not right, you know, to have these people continue to work as they have been. I think each of them is probably carrying a half more than they should, and what my hope would be is to take, you know, some of the responsibilities from each administrative assistant and combine it into, because I think they're both working at least, you know, half more than what they would. And so that's the reason for the request, is that, as I said, you know, we've had the same staffing since 1988, and at that time there were 400 people under the board. You know, with every file, I mean, I tried to, you know, when I was talking to my analysts, both of them, you know, I tried to figure out how I could articulate to you what, you know, just what it is, you know, the life of a file or what have you, but nothing happens with regard to these clients without our staff doing something. I mean, they can't go out in the community, they can't have a hearing, they can't, you know, get modifications of the conditional release. Everything takes staff work. You know, it's the hub of the system, of the, you know, a forensic system, and everything comes through the board and out through the board, and that takes just a number, I mean, just a substantial amount of work. I can tell you that you know, as this happened, these increases, you know, we absorbed, as you can see, it was sort of slow for a while there. It went from 55 to 60, 65, 68, you know, whatever. Then it jumped to 78, and we were still doing all right. But then it jumped from 78 to 110 new clients, and then to 126 in 2004. And that happened all within this biennium. And you will also note that we've never asked for additional staff before. We have tried to manage through technological enhancements and what have you, done everything we could, asked for legislative changes, have done each step, and finally, we believe we're at the point where we can't manage without the additional person to handle it.
Thank you. Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a little confused about the growth line, mm-hmm. and Deborah, maybe you can help with this as well. In your review of this agency, you state from 99 through 2002, the board averaged 76 new cases a year. That's down in the third paragraph under budget environment. Yet, on page 18 of the blue handout book, I can't make that number come out, and I'm not sure what differences we're looking at, but it looks like to me from 1999 to 2004 you averaged 30 and a half new folks per year, and we need to reconcile that difference.
I will do that. Mr. Chair, Lieutenant Hannah, I'll do that for you. But when I wrote the analysis of the governor's recommended budget, I'm sure it must be a timing thing, and I can work with Mary Claire to get that result for you.
Okay. Follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Mary Claire, do you have information that might indicate numbers higher than what we see on page 18? Because it seems from your testimony you're talking about numbers that are considerably higher than that in growth.
Chair Richardson, Representative Hannah, I expect that these numbers are pretty much the same. What has happened, though, I think on some of the graphs in the appendix, you'll be able to see illustration is that it's not just the number of new clients that come under, it's that we don't, you know, the growth is also as a result of not losing any, because in years, you know, 10 years ago, we were averaging the same number, you know, the number of people came in under the board a year, and we discharged this about the same number, so we stayed equal. Then, if you look at the appendix, in the last tab, on appendix H, you will see that part of the reason for that growth is that in 2003 and 2004, we didn't lose as many, you know, and by lose I mean that they don't, you know, their time doesn't run out. The court puts somebody under a jurisdiction for a certain number of years, and we only lost, say, 50 in 2003 and gained the 110, so there was a net gain that year of 60, and then in 2004 lost maybe 57 but gained 126. So
I got it. I'd like to follow up again. Once again, I think it's important, and I understand you're talking about total clients now when you're talking about that, and that's not what I'm talking about.
I'm sorry.
I'm talking about new.
Okay.
As reported on page 18, by your graph, you're averaging 30.5 per year. From 2003 to 2004, you showed a growth of 66 clients. If you go to Appendix G, as you note in your appendix items, mm-hmm. you go from 2003, from 2004 to 126. I'd just like to reconcile which of those is the correct, because they appear to be comparing the same numbers, but they're just different numbers.
Okay. We'll do that.
Anyway, while you're looking at graph or in Appendix H, would you comment as to why there isn't, you know, it looks like the discharges is actually, you know, less than what it was certainly in 02, but, you know, I'm seeing a pretty flat chart. It goes up and down, but if you drew a line across on discharges, but the intake is increasing so much, why would there not be a corresponding, at least some increase in discharges?
Chair Richardson, that's solely a product of the number of years that an individual is placed under the board by the court. And as I mentioned earlier, 96% are felonies, and of those, 75% are serious felonies. So we're looking at usual 20-year, and obviously murders come under for life. So we're not, you know, those people just don't run out. I mean, we have them for a lot longer, and that's what... you know, would explain that. Is it just the sentences are much longer, so we don't lose as many? Fewer misdemeanors are coming under the board. Only 4% come under for misdemeanors, which the maximum sentence is a year. So,
are you saying Measure 11 sentencing directly applies to this population as well?
No, I'm sorry, Chair Richardson, it doesn't. But what I'm saying is that those kind of offenses, which we're seeing more of, have, even under our system, obviously have the greater lengths of sentence of length of jurisdiction, which is 20 years for a Class A felony. So a lot.
That explains that. Thank you.
And you would note on Appendix I that that's those lapses are we are not in the next biennia or more looking at any more than 50 persons per year running out of time, despite the fact that we're receiving even a conservative number. If we don't keep at 126, if you took a conservative number of 100, we're still going to be net gaining 50 or 60 more clients, you know, per year in this population.
What is the justification for using a straight line graph to project increased number of clients in the future?
In the future. Chair Richards, are you talking about Appendix F?
E.
I'm sorry.
There's a tendency to use, you know, just to do straight line, and yet there could be an aberration. For instance, you've said, you know, there's been a change in Measure 11, or Measure 11, but also a change in the OHP.
Mm-hmm.
And so supposing that there was a change in the OHP that allowed greater mental treatment, then would that affect this graph? I'm just wondering what's the justification to take 2 years and shoot a graph off based on the last 2 years, when if you look before that, you have 10 years, mm-hmm. and if you average all the 10 years, it would be a substantially less of a drastic increase.
Chair Richardson, it was only to illustrate what would happen if, in fact, our numbers, you know, remain the same. This was not to indicate that that would, but as you see, it was, say, projected. If, in fact, we were to continue on this projectile, basically, of because we've gone from the 78 to 110 to 126, if we continued on that kind of
trajectory.
Yeah. Then that's where we might end up, and that's just as a caution.
Okay.
I think that basically covers the materials for phase one. If members have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Are there other questions? I think that you've answered everything that we've brought up. You've had. Give us some very detailed information.
One,
appreciate that.
One quick question. Maybe it won't be a quick. Maybe it'll be a real long, ugly question, but we'll do our best.
I leave now.
If there were community programs available for everyone that could possibly be served in those community programs, what impact would that have on the state hospital? How many people do you think are really ready to go out into a community-based setting that you're currently confined?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen, I can tell you that the board has already found, I believe, 39 individuals appropriate for conditional release, has made that finding through a hearings process. Those are individuals who have come before the board, and that determination has already been made. So clearly those individuals have been identified. There are an additional 40 or 50 clients who may not have either, you know, gotten to the board yet for the board to make that finding, but clearly the hospital has indicated to us, and I will tell you that we are engaged in a very intensive process right now where we meet on a weekly basis with the Office of Mental Health, myself, and the state hospital staff, and have a running list of persons whom the hospital thinks could be, you know, released to the community if the adequate resources to meet their needs was available. And that list is probably 90 to 100. And I believe that the board would be, you know, more than happy to conditionally release these individuals if the community were to accept them and if the resources, the appropriate resources and support services were there. We're not just talking about buildings to put them in, but obviously the community has to have the treatment services and the support services that the individual needs as well. But if that were to occur, and as I said, you know, the office and is projecting, you know, as many as 95 new facilities or beds in the community by June, that would obviously have a substantial impact on the hospital. They are currently, at least last I heard, 48, 50 over census. We took 90 out. Not only are you not over census, you're actually down a ward. I think it's critical for not only our clients but that are getting out, but also for the clients who remain in the hospital, because this overcrowding obviously affects the ability for the staff to even perform treatment. I think it's seriously suffering because of the overcrowding. It's very difficult for the, you know, treatment teams to deal with 40 or 42 individuals on a ward when they're much more effective at 30, 32, which is what they were designed for. So I think it would have a significant impact and would also benefit those who are sitting in the hospital not in need of that level of care. Because, you know, one thing that our clients struggle with is after the board finds them appropriate, they wait and wait and wait for these, you know, for this community slot to be available. And, you know, at times they lose hope, or, you know, they start going backwards. You know, they've got to the point where we thought they were going to be out, and then it takes a long time. And that does have a detrimental effect on a client and their treatment. So we're ever hopeful. I just think it would be a great improvement not only to the state hospital but to the clients in the system as a whole. I think, you know, one of the problems, the reason we're in this difficulty right now is because, you know, last biennium we were precluded from doing this process because the money was, as you recall from the special session, was returned to the, we all had to give back some money, and the money that went back from, you know, DHS's budget included our caseload growth. We were in this process last biennium and only got like 9 beds developed, whereas this, you know, biennium, as I said, we're hoping to get 96, and that's a huge difference. And if we had been able to do this last, you know, biennium as well as this, because I think it is going to be an ongoing need, but if we did it consistently, I think we could keep the census at the hospital at a much more reasonable level.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could I bring your attention again to page 18, the upper graph, because I've answered one of the questions to myself, at any rate, about the numbers. The graph on the top of page 18 matches Appendix E. This really indicates persons under jurisdictions as evidenced by the following chart. So this is the total folks you're dealing with here, not the new growth.
That's correct.
Okay.
This one was how many were under the board on December 31st of each of those years.
Right. So I have, because I've answered that question, it gives me a new one.
Oh.
If you say that you're averaging 110 people per year new, and you look at the graph on the top of page 18, and you're only averaging 30 and a half people additional new per year, it doesn't seem like the graph Appendix H would be correct. That would sort of belie the fact that you're turning loose more people than you're getting.
Chair Richardson, Representative Hannah, I'm not saying that we are adding 126 to our the number, the 110 and the 126 were new clients for each of those two calendar years.
Mm-hmm.
They obviously, you know, because we lost some, there isn't a growth in 2003 and
not a net increase.
No, it wasn't. It was the total number that came under that year, which was not the net growth.
But you see where I'm, follow up, please. You see where I'm coming from on this. If you're averaging from 99 to 2002, 76 new cases a year, which is what the data says,
mm-hmm.
but the total number of people under your board's review is only averaging 30 and a half people a year,
mm-hmm.
don't you have to be releasing more people than you're getting?
Well, not necessarily. Sure. If you have 100 and you're letting out 50, then you only have 50 increase.
Right.
So if they have an 80 and they're letting out 50, then they would have 30 increase.
That
would be the net increase, but those numbers aren't the same.
But the number says you're getting 76 new, right?
Is that net or gross new?
Well, it says the board averages 76 new cases a year, right?
Okay, but let's see what was meant by that.
Well, and Mr. Chair, Representative Hannah, if I could have the opportunity then to go back and I think I know what your question is, and I can reconcile that with Mary Claire. It could be that she's at a disadvantage in that you're looking at my analysis, which she hasn't seen. And so I just like the opportunity to reconcile those two things, and I do understand what your question is. I could have been wrong in my analysis.
That's okay. That'd be all right if they converse and get back with you on that. So that.
Okay, but I want to be clear here. What this would mean is that Appendix H wouldn't be correct. It would mean you would have to be turning loose more people than you're getting, based on those numbers. Just so we know what we're trying to resolve here.
All right. With that, phase one presentation is concluded. We appreciate your time and all the work that you've given us, and we are adjourned.
Thank you.